Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kale Teeter, Evan Basilik, and Sujit Mello, discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com. Welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 172, being recorded on the 30th of March, 2017. I'm Sujit, and on Skype with me, I have Kale and Evan. And it's just the old gang back together. We don't have any special guests today. We did have one actually lined up for yesterday, but it was a product group, product team. And well, who shall remain nameless? But they of course had.
They had. It was important. It was.
They
worth
had
it, right?
I agree. Yeah.
Yeah. They'll share it. Maybe
product
next
teams
week.
Deliver products, and that comes first, right?
Yes. Customers and products come first. So.
So we gave them okay. You know, you guys go finish your product, get it delivered, and then we'll come back and talk to you later. And it's a good topic.
Hopefully we'll get some extra features out of giving them an extra, you know, couple of weeks.
There we go. Yep. So isn't, talking of that, isn't Build coming up sometime?
May.
May, right?
May 11th, yeah. I think.
Getting there.
So again, we can expect the usual. I'm sure there's a lot of these features are being queued up for that too, right? They like to release a lot of stuff around that time.
Yeah, we'll have to start, you know, double checking ourselves as far as what's public yet and what's not, right?
Yeah, we don't want to get ahead of the marketing team, otherwise we get into trouble. Yeah. We've seen those emails. Okay, so let's see. So thanks, Evan. I know you did another great job putting a whole bunch of things into the show notes. So let's start with some of the recent updates. And who wants to go first? Anything in particular you guys like? Evan, you can go first.
I'm actually going to go. So I'm going to go with an update that's a subtraction. You know, we've talked, I can't remember the last time we talked about it, but we talked about some of the features and functionality showing up in the Azure portal now instead of, you know, the portal.azure.com instead of the, you know, previous one before that. I won't say the older portal because there's even an older one or two before that one. But the previous portal, you know, the manage that Windows Azure one, and we talked about things moving, you know, showing up in the new portal, portal.azure.com. But now what we're starting to see is features and functionality actually drop out of manage.windows.azure.com, mm-hmm. right? So we're starting to see, you know, moving towards, you know, deprecating and turning off that portal, which, you know, part of the way to do that is start pushing, you know, pieces of functionality and start pulling services out of that in an attempt to kind of, you know, make sure everybody's moving. And encourage the feature teams to move as well, right, to be honest.
Right, right, right. I mean, it's about time, right? I think that we've had the new portal around for a very long time, already gone through a couple of versions of it. So you can't say it's new anymore. This is
yeah, yeah. Right. It's been, I guess it went GA 2 years ago, a year or 2 years ago, a while ago.
I would say 2014, 2015, around that time, yeah.
Has it been that long? I guess it might have been. Yeah, but it's been a while, right? It's time, right? It definitely brings a lot of benefits. You know, the layout is nicer. The managing, you know, you get the ARM capabilities just out of the box, and so yeah, it's time to move. So if you haven't started using it, you know, it's time to take the plunge, and you're gonna not have a choice.
So are there any reasons to stick with the old portal? I know at some point we had some services that only worked in the old portal. Is that still the case? Is there anything that only works with the old portal? Right
yeah,
now?
I mean, there are still services. We won't. I don't know. I'm tempted to call out the dev teams because one of them is a service I support, but I won't do that to them. They'll hunt me down. But yeah, there are definitely some services that have not yet been able to make the jump to ARM and to the new portal. But I know they're. You know, for the example, the one that I work with directly, they are working frantically on doing that. That's really high on their priority list, and they're working hard on it. It's just not architecturally, it's not as easy for them as some other services.
Right. Okay, that's a good one. Yeah. How about you, Kale? What do you like?
I got a couple. One was because I work a lot with the marketplace, obviously, with blockchain, but like other partners we're putting in there from the DX side. Obviously, people are aware of when you go into the portal that we've just been talking about, when you hit marketplace, there's all kinds of solutions in there, both first party and third party. But what people may not be aware of is that we do have like SaaS offerings as well. So you can think of those too as being something where we're integrating with partners who might not necessarily have a template or something like that that you can actually just spin up in your, inside your application. They may be kind of hosting it on behalf of you, and you pay a subscription fee to use that product. And I just wanted to call out the fact that there is a blog post on this, and we can put it in the show notes around this App Accelerate and some of the details around that. So if people have partners that they're working with, or if you're looking for a partner-based solution that maybe you don't see in Azure directly, you can also look into this area for some of the SaaS vendors and whatnot.
What's the difference between like the software as a service or the SaaS apps that come with Azure Active Directory, right, where you can kind of propagate your credentials, you know, over to Box and over to Salesforce and all the different, you know, kind of SaaS apps that are out there, which there's thousands in the Azure AD.
Typically.
What's the difference between that and the marketplace stuff?
Yeah, typically the model is, so from a marketplace perspective, you can think of that as like you're in your tenant. So you have your subscription and you're running the bits from the vendor in your subscription, whether it's through a VM or a PaaS service or any of the stuff that we have in Azure. And obviously from that standpoint, we can do things like hook that up to your Azure Active Directory as part of that deployment. When you think about a SaaS vendor, it's a bit more disconnected. So in that model, again, you're thinking about it from more of a perspective of maybe you don't even have an Azure account, and you certainly wouldn't need one. But you could basically find them through our AppSource or whatnot through I just mentioned, and kind of you get directed to the partner site who potentially is running that on Azure behind the scenes. And essentially, you're going to go into a management portal there and basically sign up. And then as part of that, you can basically provide your tenant ID for your Azure Active Directory, which essentially is just getting injected into the rapid runtime to be able to redirect you to the right provider whenever it says, okay, authenticate this guy.
So it sounds like they actually end up being the same thing under the covers. It's just a different place.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Because especially if your app is something like that's really popular, you know, like Salesforce or something like that, where they're kind of mature, they already have like that built into their application where you can just it's a pluggable model for where it needs to go to authenticate.
Right. Yeah. Because I mean that's where kind of Azure AD comes in. Okay. I didn't realize that these were surfacing through the marketplace as well as through there's a whole Azure AD portal for
the model there is. Yeah, the model there is like, you know, when you search in Azure, when you hit that little plus sign and hit new and type in, you know, like a first-party service, you can also type in like third-party ones and, basically it'll direct you over and onboard you into that one, which isn't even running in your tenant, so.
Gotcha. Okay, so it's kind of a landing place, right? Marketplace is the right word for it in this context, so okay.
Yeah, and I think the word SaaS is used in a sense that these are all examples of SaaS applications, right? Like, what are some of those marketplace apps? I think it's some of the CMS applications, right? CRM apps that are in Azure. They're examples of SaaS applications. Salesforce is another SaaS application. It's just not hosted in Azure, right? It's hosted in its own data center, as is Box and others. Box may be hosted in AWS. I don't know. But these are hosted elsewhere. They're all SaaS applications. The authentication one example is where you can authenticate against a SaaS application. You might be able to authenticate against a SaaS application that's actually hosted in Azure as well. From an authentication perspective, those things can point to SaaS apps anywhere, right? Mm-hmm. But in the marketplace, the ones that Kayla's talking about, all of them have to be in Azure. Those are Azure-hosted SaaS applications that you can take advantage of, you can sign up for, and pay for them.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Okay. Cool.
So another cool one I liked in the stuff that you put out there, Evan, was around the Azure Dev Test Labs now being available in a whole bunch of other regions. But Along with that, they threw another nice feature. So one of the things that people liked about Dev Test Labs is that you could set up a VM and you could automatically make it shut down, right? Just so that you don't incur the cost of running a VM that you just use for testing a feature, for example. And generally, people love that feature, right? Being able to shut down VMs
I use it with
automatically.
my ARM VMs all the
Exactly, and that's exactly now. So that feature is now available not just in Dev Test Lab, it's available in any ARM VM. There's a little feature, a little setting in there. You say, I want to auto shut down. You put the time that you want to auto shut down. And you can even put a notification that you get through like a webhook in there, like a Slack webhook or something else that you might be using on premise, or you have a service for that. And the thing will shut down automatically at that time. So I think that's a great thing that they took that learning from Dev Test Labs and made it available to everybody else.
Agreed.
And then how about this web application firewall? I thought that was. I mean, we need to do a topic on this, right? Somehow we've not done an episode on this one. The web application firewall. This is something that they added on to the gateway, I believe, right? The
Yeah,
web.
it's part of the Azure Application Gateway capability. And yeah, the WAF is really nice because, again, some of this is if you've been in web apps and development, you all know don't be watch for SQL injection, watch for cross scripting, right? All those kind of things. But if you're a developer just writing code and maybe you haven't really thought about the security side of things or you don't have experience with it, you can put this WAF in front and it'll it becomes the proxy in between you and the and your end users. But now it means an attacker is going to go through the application firewall. And a lot of the common security issues, SQL injection, cross-site scripting, it will block them for you. It'll take care of them for you. So your code doesn't have to do anything or manage it. It'll handle it for you. And
Now,
I
of
think there's
course,
actually going to be more coming over time.
we still want our application developers to prevent against those things. So it doesn't
Absolutely,
mean that
yeah.
we want them to be lazy and say, oh, yeah, we'll just accept any SQL query from the internet. The WAF will
Yeah.
protect us.
Yeah, no, it's I think it's a good. So I've seen it where I've actually seen it used a lot is where somebody puts that in front just as that extra layer of protection, but they also somebody tries to DDoS a site, you stick a WAF in front of it and can basically say, hey, you know what, traffic from these IPs, nope, sorry, you're not getting through, right? And it can kind of help manage that at that point without you having to kind of build that capability or functionality, or going in kind of ongoing manage the IaaS capabilities, and not every web server has that same ability to do that. So
Right. And it's probably worth mentioning that, as you said, this is part of the overall application gateway, right? Azure Application Gateway service, which I think is something we haven't talked about much, but that's like this layer 7 network routing service that they offer. You can do things like SSL termination, true round robin load balancing, cookie base. If you have services that require cookie base affinity for some reason, you could do that. So it has a lot of features in there that are included. So you get the file, you get the application gateway that also includes the WAF now. That's you get the whole thing in one package. Nice. What else? Anything else? What's with this Linux backup thing? Is that new? Where we can now instantly restore files from Azure Linux VM backups?
yeah, this is just kind of extending the capability you've got for Windows VM restore stuff, where now you don't have to restore a file to get back to it, right? You can kind of mount it as a device that you can then browse through and see your files to recover them,
I
right?
see, I
Versus
see.
having to kind of restore the data to go back and get it. Just makes it a lot
Oh.
easier to recover these things and kind of individual files.
I see. Oh, so you're kind of mounting, it's like mounting a tar file directly and looking at it,
Yeah,
something like
exactly.
that. Yeah.
Yep.
Cool. Okay. So I think that's a roundup of all the news for this week. So let's get to discuss a topic which I think has become fairly popular, and it was actually Cale's idea that we dig back into this area. A lot of people, of course, show interest in it. And Cale, you want to kick us off here?
Yeah, I thought it'd be good to kind of talk through because there's been a lot of enhancements over the, I guess it's maybe it's been over a year now. I'm not sure when this, I can't remember when this first launched, our Azure Container Service, and some of the new features. We have a registry now, and just kind of talk through, hey, what's supported there? Because there's all kinds of different containers we can run now, and it further gets blurred with some of the features that I'm sure are close to CG Tart with Service Fabric. So it's something to kind of touch base on and see where we are, and just kind of share some of our experiences with not only just using Azure Container Service, but containers in general. Some of the kind of things I know I work with these quite frequently, especially Docker. And so there's been certain things that I run into that, at first I was like, I'm not sure how to do that. And so just kind of wanted to share some of those experiences as well.
So, can I ask you a question right off the bat, since you mentioned Docker? What's the difference between running an image in ACS, a Docker image in ACS, versus, say, deploying your own Docker, I don't know, cluster and doing it yourself? Right? I mean, you could do that, right? Like you could get a Docker license and put that there, or you could run it in ACS. Is there something you lose in either way? I know one's like a managed offering and one's not, but why is it that there are still a lot of people that put their own Docker clusters out there as VMscale says or whatever, or just using VMs?
I mean, I can comment on my side, I'll let Evan comment, but from my standpoint, I mean, ACS is a service that we put in Azure to basically make that easier. So when you start standing those things up, as with any of these kind of complex services, there's multiple pieces to it. It's not just go click one button and you're done. There's a lot of different pieces you need to download and run if you're going to try to run it yourself, which is totally possible. But when you look at Azure Container Services and Azure in general, the model is typically, let's take something that's kind of a nuisance to kind of do, that kind of consumes your time other than working on what you really want to be working on, which is actually running your containers or your application, and just make that easier and get that down to as few clicks as possible. So from my standpoint, I see that as well as like the integration with not just the portal, but like our command lines and our APIs. So that's kind of like you might not think of at first, but being able to spin up like Kubernetes or Mesos, obviously you can go download those bits and install all those pieces you want to, but you're going to spend time doing that rather than just coming to Azure and basically fill out a couple parameters in a template and say, go build that for me. I'll go get a cup of coffee. I'll be right back and we'll be ready to go.
Right. No, I understand. I mean, that's the beauty of having a managed service. I was just wondering if are we losing something by taking the ACS approach, right? Is there some downside to that? Like, or are we limited to some limited functionality, or do you get everything? Like, you get the entire Docker command set, for example. Is that all available to you?
Yeah, I mean, there is some limitations, right? So specifically, you're talking about Docker, but if you said something like Docker Swarm, which is one of the kind of models that we have in ACS, that's not fully supported, the Swarm mode. So there's been, if you follow Docker Swarm, there's been several revisions of that. And essentially, they're basically increasing the features that that thing can do. So when you compare it, if you took like a year ago and compared Docker Swarm to something like Mesos or DCOS, obviously DCOS and Mesosphere was a much more enterprise kind of ready, kind of more features, can kind of handle everything for you, where Swarm was a bit more basic, but they're adding features to it to basically bring those to kind of a bit more parity. Those, just to comment though, that those pieces aren't fully all enabled. So if you're asking Sajid if everything works in there, that's one downside I would say. If you install Docker Swarm yourself, there are some features you can do, but because it's so new, it takes the team, time to integrate
Sure,
those
sure,
pieces.
sure. Okay.
I
That
mean,
can
I think that
understand. Yeah.
I was gonna say. I mean, I think that's kind of you were saying kind of from my perspective. What's the difference between the the managed service and the other one? I think that's really what it comes down to. I mean, this I think Kale, you said it earlier. Like, that's kind of the model where the managed service abstracts some things that add some complexity, but it also means that maybe you don't have all the knobs that if you have a fully, you know,
right.
if you're kind of
it's probably that
80-20
rule, something like that there.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's the big distinction, right? You may not get every bell and whistle of if you deployed your own stuff, but you get enough that it's, you know, for 80-90% of the people, it's plenty, right? And so for those people, the managed service is a simpler solution.
Yep. Yeah, and I would say with like something like DCOS, it's even more complex, right? Because like that's made up of multiple pieces. There's Marathon, there's like a scheduler, there's a bunch of different components that make that whole thing up. And so again, you can spend an hour or two and go try to find all those bits and install them and spin up the VMs and all that kind of thing, or you can, you know, select a couple parameters and have it do it for you.
Okay. And so I know are we talking Linux here? I just want to make sure we get the operating system down first. Oh, is it Windows? Lead us there.
So, you know, my exposure to this, and correct me if I'm wrong, anyone, but the Linux are supported by all the orchestrators up there. So we basically support DCOS, Swarm, and Kubernetes. Obviously, I mentioned swarm mode. There's some limitations there, but we do support all three of those at some level with Linux, and then Windows is supported with Kubernetes in preview. That's my understanding of what we have supported up there right now.
Okay, so we do support Windows containers as well as Linux containers in ACS.
That's right.
Okay. Now, did I read somewhere that even though you use a Windows container service in ACS, you still need Linux nodes for the head nodes? Is that correct?
That I'm not sure about.
I believe the head
I'm
nodes
sure
are still Linux nodes, but you know the actual worker nodes, right? The ones that host the containers, they are actually they'll be Windows machines, obviously, because they're running the Windows images.
I see. Yeah, the one thing I would say about just from some real world experience with ACS, so there's some really cool features. So, you know, from a scaling perspective. If you think about what's happening here, so essentially we have to have VMs, right? Because we're going to run a workload on a VM. But these container things sit on top of these container frameworks, sit on top of these things, and allow us to run these abstracted workloads on there. So when you think about that, it's like multiple levels of scaling. So we could take like a big, super big VM and run a bunch of containers on it. And so stuff like if you took Mesosphere, for instance, really easy to do that in the interface and kind of set up different kind of scaling metrics and things you can use there to basically add more containers to an existing VM. I think they call them nodes up there is the way they address them. But then you think about it at another level and say, wait a second, we have this thing called VM scale sets. So how does that play in? Because like we could scale that too. So what happens if we scale the VM scale set underneath one of these clusters, what happens to the containers on them, all those kind of, so it's an interesting kind of thing to think through, and we do have really good support for one way. So going up is actually pretty nice. So we have some integration built in there so that even from a command line, from some of our CLI tools, or from that perspective, to be able to say, hey, when you know we see the average CPU get above this point, we can actually scale the VM scale set and basically build another node out and add it to the cluster automatically. And Mesosphere, specifically, I'll speak to that one, would pick it up and add it to its available nodes that it's allowed to run on. And then you could also have that automatically start laying container instances on it, which is kind of cool. Now, the opposite, I'm just being straight up here, is like the going down is a bit rougher. Because if you think about it, when you're running your app inside the container, let's say it's a web app, connection draining and things like that are pretty tricky because now you're at like layer 7, you're at the application level. And so if the VM scale set said, hey, it's time for me to scale down, he could pull one of the nodes out and you know, tools like Mesos and those frameworks with DCOS can recognize that and say, okay, that's cool. We'll just remove that kind of zombie node now because he's gone, and things can function if you're fully stateless. But you know, customers typically ask for graceful things like, can we when it's time to scale down, basically drain connections out of there and drain the container a bit and then pull it out gracefully. And yeah, it's a gap right now. I'm just being straight up. It's something for people to think about whenever you're thinking about these peaky workloads with ACS. So I'd say that's one. And then the other piece I wanted to kind of talk through, this is what I kind of mentioned to you guys, or said to you at least earlier, was, you start working with these Docker containers, and Docker is pretty rich with the kind of support. If you haven't worked with it recently, it's really nice. From basically, you can create these images, or you can pull them from like a Docker Hub area, which are basically pre-configured images that maybe have like a specific type of application installed or a specific web server or something of that nature. So you could pull these things down and run them, and you can do it through the Docker command line when you start getting used to this. And the interesting thing that I run into a lot is, there's a public repo out there that has, things that companies have put out there, almost like a GitHub, basically, for Docker. So you could pull those things down, but what if you want to tweak them? So, like, and I run into this all the time, but basically, like, if there's a container up there and we like it, we just want to run with a specific version of it, but there's an application settings file or something inside of there that we need to tweak at runtime. So what do we do there? And I kind of went around on this a while myself, trying to figure out, like, what's the best way to kind of do that? Like, we could, our options are take that container and modify it and then basically bake it again and create our own image, which is interesting. But what if it's dynamic? Like, what if the setting that we need to inject in here is dynamic? So then I was thinking, well, what we could do, you can start up the container, and then basically you can run these commands to mount the file system or even interact with the file system at runtime from Docker command line. So you can basically say, hey, there's an app file that's sitting in this directory on this machine, and when you start up, go replace it with this. And then you can just bounce the instance or bounce the container, and you have your new app settings in there, and everything was done at runtime, and you're still using the public version of it.
So it's kind of like a startup task for containers, right?
Yeah, yeah. I've been looking, Docker Compose, which is another tool mentioned, which is really cool if you start playing around with containers, allows you to basically create almost like our ARM templates that we talk about a lot, the kind of a JSON type format, and you can just describe your infrastructure for Docker to be like, okay, I want to fire up these three containers, and here's the ports I want to expose, and here's the image they should use when they mount themselves, or, and it'll go try to grab those from either a private repo or a public repo at runtime if it doesn't already have the image, and then it'll go ahead and mount it. But what's cool about that is Docker Compose, let's say you wanted to run like three instances of a specific web server or an application stack that exists, when you run that Docker Compose file, it'll just go grab the image once. So it'll say, oh, I see a dependency here, I don't have it, I'll go grab that image, and then it just keeps it once, and then it'll do three different deployments and configure them the way you need it.
Oh, I see. And I suppose the nice thing with the Docker Compose is then you don't have to, run the Docker command multiple times with all those parameters, right? And normally you got to pass like the port number and other things, but yeah, it's all in the file, and you just say, okay, Docker, whatever, I don't know what the command is, but run this, take this compose file, this JSON file, and go with it.
That's correct. It's really slick. If the people or listeners haven't checked it out, you should definitely take a look at it. It's really cool.
No, you talked about registries, Kale. So what are the options for registry? You mentioned the Docker public repo. Are there other registries that they can point to? You just configure the registry you want to use in ACS, for example?
Yeah, so that's another issue I run into a lot with partners, because as I mentioned before, there's a Docker registry service, like a public version Docker Hub, which is similar to GitHub. And it's, I think you have to pay once you put so many of them up there, but you could put like one or maybe, no, I think it's free actually. It's like GitHub.
I think you're allowed one, I think, right? If I remember right.
Yeah, I think maybe there's some restriction there, but regardless, you basically create your Docker file, you create your image, and then you can upload it, and then anybody in the world can basically address into, very similar to GitHub, so they would say, like, I could create like an AZ podcast repository, and then inside of there I could store a bunch of images, and basically that's what you put in your Docker Compose or Docker run line, and it'll pull it at runtime. So that's cool. But the problem with that is it's public, right? So what if somebody says, well, I have stuff I want to distribute to only certain people through, they have to authenticate through some means in order to get access to this. And so that's where these private repos come from. Now, Docker Hub, you can pay, very similar to like GitHub, where basically GitHub, you can put all kinds of public stuff up there for free, but if you want to do a private one, then you pay. Same thing here. So you can basically pay to have a private repo, and then it forces authentication. So Docker has built-in capabilities where you can authenticate or log into Docker. And then from that, you can navigate to these other registries and pull images from those. And so that's an option. But then we have a new feature. I don't think it's GA yet. I believe it's still in preview, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it's called the Container Registry Service in Azure. Which is taking that another step. Basically, inside Azure, we're able to manage a registry of these private container images and authenticate and pull those so that they're not just sitting out there in the public space.
This is basically so that you don't have to manage your own registry. You kind of leverage our pre-built service for it, right?
That's right. And our APIs and all that kind of cool stuff that goes along with it.
Right, okay.
Yeah, I think you're right. That's still in preview, the Azure Registry Container. And I believe I may have read somewhere that we that also offers a public and a private versions, right? You could have them. I think you can have your own. It's been an ask, I know that, from customers to be able to have an enterprise registry for mm-hmm. containers. And I think that's something that they're looking at as well.
Yeah, I think it's cool. I see that as something that maybe we could expand on because, like I mentioned, with the marketplace, we're always looking to kind of advance that as well so we can have Docker images there that are under authentication, like a service principal name or something of that nature in order to authenticate to get in there.
Now, so you talked about some of the Swarm and the Kubernetes and DCOS, and those are orchestrators, I think, is the term they use, right, mm-hmm. in the container world. So as you mentioned earlier, there's also Azure Service Fabric, right? And it turns out Azure Service Fabric is also basically a very, very efficient orchestrator. That's really what it is. And it can orchestrate containers as well. You could, just instead of, a container is what? It's an executable that's essentially running your image. That's the easiest way to think of a container. In the Docker sense, it's the Docker EXE, right? So the Docker EXE is provided an image, and then somehow it creates this kind of sandbox environment in that executable to run your image, and that image could be a Linux image or a Windows image, for example. So same thing, since Service Fabric is essentially this facility where it can run executables efficiently, they can also run containers efficiently. And it turns out the orchestrator in Service Fabric is very, very good, because they've been, Service Fabric has been around for a while, in 5 or 6 years maybe, and they've perfected the art of orchestrating those nodes and make the capacity as dense as possible in the available hardware that's provided to Service Fabric. So they do a good job of moving images around the nodes to based on load and things like that. So just want to mention out there that there is another orchestrator, which it doesn't get mentioned a whole lot, but that's the Service Fabric orchestrator. Of course, Service Fabric orchestrator is limited to Windows containers currently, because Service Fabric in GA is the Windows version. There is a preview version of Service Fabric running on Linux, and that would, of course, come with Linux containers, as you would expect.
Now, is that, when you say container, Sajid, I guess I don't. So I understood Service Fabric. This thing's an animal. but I understand that thing from when I used it myself. It was basically like I was bringing my app, and I could deploy it through this special way, which had this really cool kind of like API or like SDK, really, where I could basically tell it, hey, I want these things to be more resilient or reliable, I think they call it, collections and things like that in the cloud, which was really cool. How does the containers thing manifests itself? Do I go to like Hyper-V and create a container? Like, how does that work?
No. So Service Fabric is, and I don't want to take up the whole episode on Service Fabric because we could, but real quickly, Service Fabric is essentially a mechanism to be able to run executables, right? Any it can run any, you can provide it any exe, and it will make it run very, very efficiently on all the hardware that's provided, and it'll be run reliably. That's where the reliable comes in. It will always make sure that that exe is running. If it falls somewhere, it'll stand it up somewhere else. But there'll always be that exe or any number of instances of that exe that you say running. That's what it guarantees you. Now, that exe could be a number of things. It could be just a Hello World exe, you know, a console application, or it could be something a little more fancy, like a service, like they call these reliable services is the name that you probably heard. Now, reliable services essentially compile down to an exe, believe it or not. That's yet another exe. Or you want to have a web application? Sure. That also compiles to an EXE, an ASP.NET Core web application in Service Fabric compiles to an EXE. So you're running yet another EXE. So all these things are just EXEs that Service Fabric is running. And guess what? Containers is yet another EXE. It's essentially an EXE that's hosting your container. So in the Windows case, that's using it's taking advantage of the containers service that's available in Windows Server 2016, the container, the container extensions or whatever you call it. So that's the base image that's used for all the VMs that are hosting Service Fabric. If you want to use containers, you can use Service Fabric without containers, in which case you will use the Windows Server 2012 image as your base to host the Service Fabric nodes. But if you intend to run Windows containers, the Service Fabric nodes themselves will be running Windows Server 2016, and so you'll be using those. You mentioned Hyper-V, and maybe that's what they use under the covers. They may be using the Hyper-V containers, but the images are the same thing. You know, you point to a registry, just like you mentioned earlier, and you can say, I want a nano server image, and it'll suck down a nano server image. It's about 1 gigabyte in size, and it will run it, and that's the easiest way to get going on one of those.
I see. Yeah, I think I read something, and we could drop a link in the show notes, and this was a little while back, but I did read something that they were using Docker under the covers there, and so you could actually, like, the stuff we mentioned before with like Docker Hub or these private registries, you can actually put them in your service manifest and basically pull those down. So that's really cool that we can use the same mechanism in Service Fabric.
Yep. And I said the advantage is that the orchestration part, right? Because again, Docker is just the hosting of your containers. The orchestrators are all these other things that you mentioned, like Kubernetes and Docker Swarm and DCOS. That's the complicated part of containers. People don't always realize that the complexity comes in the orchestration, not in the actual hosting of your containers. So that orchestration has to be very, very robust. And I think the ones out there are good. The ones for Linux are very good. But in the Windows world, we don't have too many options. You just said Kubernetes, right, is the one that is available in the Windows world, at least in ACS. And the other option would be to use Service Fabric, which is very, very, very reliable. And it's been around for a long time. It's quite mature. So yeah, so that's my take on Service Fabric. Sorry, I hadn't mentioned it in a while at a show. Finally got it in there.
You didn't even have to work very hard for that one. That was like, you know,
Kale just laid it down for me.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Just laid it out.
And you guys will notice I didn't mention the BC service this time. So
no, you did at the beginning. There was the words were used. Yes. So
the words were used. Okay, sorry.
They were used. So. We'll give you your opportunity again next week.
Sure. But a lot of discussion comes up, like, you know, what do you use containers for, right? What are you seeing out there? Like, what are the use cases people are using containers for? Is it for everybody? I sometimes I feel people use it for too many things.
That's probably it's like everything else, right? There's an element of, hey, let's go use it because it's cool and it's new and it's shiny.
Right.
And then there's, hey, it makes sense for this situation. Right?
Yeah.
And so I'm sure there's a little bit of that.
I find it really helpful, like especially if I'm just like trying something new out. So if there's some new application or some new thing that I want to kind of try out in whatever I'm working on here, and they have a Docker, like if they have an image of it, it's like super easy to like, I mean, in like 5 minutes I'm running. I think that's just awesome. Like I don't have to install anything. I just go grab this image, mount it, and I'm ready to roll. And that can go, okay, let me see how this thing works and dig into it.
And I
Certainly,
totally
it's
understand
production
from a
quality.
from a development perspective. I totally get that, right? I'm talking about that. Would you then run that in production that way? That's my question. Like, should you then do that same thing in production? Now that you've tested it out with this particular image, you know that okay, this particular feature or API works. Are you still going to do the same thing in production? You're going to just host containers?
And I'll give my take on it. I mean, the from a versioning perspective, just think about it from that aspect. So the entire infrastructure, the entire, if you basically the VM, if you think about it at that level, the whole thing that you're running your app inside of, you could just version it. And so I can basically, like, once I have that thing kind of tested, I know it works. And if something gets fuzzy, oh, this isn't working, just kill it and restart it, just like you said with like Service Fabric, and I'm back to a known good state automatically.
True, but then that means that if you do create a new version, you're essentially your entire operating system, the whole image is brand new, right? You may have changed one, I don't know, one file in the image, let's say, okay? But guess what? The entire image is now brand new, correct?
I actually think that's a good thing, actually. Like, because yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I mean, I'm kind of torn about that as well, because I know that when I talk to customers about building, you know, PaaS VMs or even IaaS VMs, right, my stance has always been you should always get latest and greatest, because the odds of something new breaking you, especially if you have a, you know, if it's pretty small, and most of the time, you know, if you do it right, there's a very easy rollback, versus the odds of moving forward giving you know, more stability fixes, that kind of stuff is very, very high. So I tend to fall on it's not a bad thing to always get the latest and greatest.
No, I understand latest and greatest is fine, but I'm thinking from an enterprise perspective, from a testing perspective, okay? Using the example that I just provided, if I update a single file, let's say that we have to put a patch in, okay? We have any, we have
Right.
any, we have a service running out there. It's a complicated, you know, web application, and I'm updating one file in there. Guess what? Now with the Docker or the container approach, I'm putting a brand new image there, right? That image could be one file different, it could be 1,000 file difference, but it's different, right? And so the entire image now has to be retested from soup to nuts because you don't know how different it is. It's a different image, correct?
Yeah, I guess I mean
Versus a patch, if you do, in the old days, if you're just updating one file, you'd say, hey, you know what, just test that area, right? That's the only thing we changed. We know it, right? Everything else, 99.9% is the same.
you're saying
This
'cause
point.
it's the same exact
Exactly,
binary.
yeah. But
Yeah.
in the image case, the whole image is now brand new. You versioned it, you created a brand new version. As far as anybody's concerned, that image is something brand new, right? Everything could be different. Nothing could be different. Who knows? But it's got a different version.
Yeah, I mean, I could see that. I mean, from my perspective, I look at it as like, okay, if I had an image and then I changed it and created a new image, I know the diff, right? It wasn't like somebody slid something else in there on me. If I have a good kind of release system, I know like what I'm tracking there and what changes I made to my image. And it's very atomic then. Because like basically, I had that version one out there and here's version two. I put version two out and go, oh, wait. To your point, Sajid, I didn't think about this thing, or my test didn't cover this one area. I got a problem. I just go back to 1.0 immediately. I'm ready to roll.
Yeah, the rollback is very easy. There's no doubt about that. And I'm not saying I'm not making these comments like it's a bad thing to go with Docker. I'm just saying the where I was trying to go with this line of talk is people don't understand that is your DevOps cycle has to work differently when you deal with containers, right? If you had a traditional DevOps cycle that both, you know, normal Windows or Linux-based machines where you updated single files. Now this is whole thing because you obviously need a very good test strategy, as we just discovered, because you want to test your entire image as a whole, right? It doesn't matter whether you change one file or you change 1,000 files in there. You have to test the whole thing soup to nuts every time. you come up with a new version. And that's the important thing, that you know your test strategy has to be very robust with containers. You have your versioning strategy, as you mentioned, and also the I guess the backward compatibility, right? We have to think about too. Because I always wonder when they roll out these images, you could have like I don't know 100 instances running in the container service, and as they roll out, at some point you're going to have mixed versions in there, right? How does that work?
Yeah, I don't think there's any magic there. It's just something you got to think about as far as like your deployment strategy and like how do you do app migrations. Like, is there a big enough change that like we need to have an outage? You know, hopefully it's not that case. Hopefully you've been designed in such a way that anytime you're doing your upgrades, it's automatically being able to do that. That's tricky, as you know. It's like from years of client-server type app development, you make a database schema change. Is that going to break your app?
Right.
I mean, that's
Well, the database schema seems is done in one place. That's the difference, right? Here, this is kind of what you're saying is that some apps may know about the change and some apps may not. That's what you mean.
Some instances are still relying on the old schema or something, you know?
Yes, you're right.
So I don't know. I mean, I don't know what you guys' opinion is, but it still feels to me like you still need to do some thought about how you do your migrations or how you do your upgrades of your actual app to make sure that you don't cause downtime or an exception or something.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree. And just in generally, though, when containers, I think of containers as yet another abstraction layer, right? And it is, obviously, right? There is some abstraction that you're throwing on top. And overall, from a performance perspective, do we lose a whole lot by this extra abstraction?
I think that goes back to some of the virtualization questions we've had talked about in the past, where, right, these days virtualization and containers, the way that we've built them and we've optimized that interaction so that they don't really behave like they're so disconnected,
right?
It's very efficient as you switch through, you know, as you go through the tiers and the different layers of that design.
Yeah, they have all these virtual switches and things like that. Good point.
So
that's great.
Right.
Yeah,
but it's definitely it's a good conversation. All right, there's a lot of options out there these days, and you really kind of just pick what works for you and for your way of thinking.
So, Cale, you've been using primarily ACS. What has been your vehicle for running the containers?
No, I've used both. I haven't used Kubernetes as much, and that's not by choice. It's just that's one of our newest in that space. I've used Mesos a lot and Docker Swarm, as well as just like plain old Docker. When we're running these things, because some of our partner solutions, we do this stuff kind of manually. We don't even rely on other services to do it. We can basically script out how we want the thing to get laid down and start it up. But both of those are kind of world-class. Mesos has a really nice polished front-end kind of dashboard that allows you to kind of interact and do some cool monitoring and alerting and stuff like that on there. Swarm's a bit more of a command line kind of driven tool, but it works just as well. I mean, they work pretty nice.
Cool. Great. Well, that's very good feedback and good information there, Cale. Thanks for reviving the containers discussion. We haven't had it in a while. Anything else that we want to add before we wrap up the show here today?
No, good conversation. I always learn some stuff about this, about the possibilities out there every time we have these. You know, I'm not super deep in the container aspect of stuff, so.
It is definitely getting very hot these days. It's a good topic to talk about. Well, Cale and Evan, thank you very much for all of that. And we'll wrap it up here and see you guys next week.
Sounds good.
Thanks,
see you later.
Thanks.
Okay, bye.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle, @AzurePodcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.